Hello listeners, and welcome to another episode of the Story Explorer. Today's episode promises to be both interesting and thought-provoking. I'll be sharing again how I prepared for our latest book club evening, what questions were framed and how we answered the questions about the book Red Sorghum by Chinese author Mo Yan. I will even conclude this episode with a story I wrote inspired by Mo Yan's remarkable storytelling. I chose Red Sorghum because Mo Yan won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2012. With my book club, I traveled the world through literature, and we were nearing the end of our journey through Asia. I needed a final book from Asia to conclude my travel in this part of the world. As China obviously is such a big part of Asia and of our world, I looked for Chinese books that would be worthwhile to discuss. Mo Yan is the first and only citizen so far from China to have won this prestigious prize. The book Red Sorghum is widely known, has been translated into many languages, and it has been adapted into an acclaimed film. So I decided to go with this book. Let's begin our journey into Red Sorghum, a story tracing a family's history in rural China from the 1920s till the late 1960s. After I announced the book, Natalie Alexander, a French teacher and an enthusiastic book club member, approached me and she told me her mother had spent part of her childhood in China. That revelation immediately sparked an idea. Maybe Natalie could share some of her mother's stories to give us deeper insight into the country behind the book. We agreed to prepare book club evening together, and Natalie is here with me in the studio. Welcome, Natalie.
Thank you very much, Christy.
Later on, Natalie will read to us what I'd like to call an interlude. For now, let me take you through our experience of preparing and hosting the book club. Natalie and I met a few times over a good cup of coffee at Saint Germain and explored the complexities of this difficult read. During our first meeting, Natalie told me that what stood out to her were some traditions from China, customs her mother had spoken about, such as the sedan chair, a type of carrying seat, the wailers, who sing at funerals, and the practice of foot binding. What fascinates me is that I had completely missed those details in my first read. It reminds me that sometimes we need to hear stories or bits of history more than once before they become a particular reality or a noteworthy detail. Another element in the book that Natalie picked up on was the dark humor. She pointed it out to me right away and said, "Look, it is already there in the motto. It is so funny, this soya sauce." I just looked at Natalie and thought, "Is that funny?" I couldn't grasp the humor of it at all. I've come to realize that I often miss dark humor. Last year, when we discussed The Master and the Margarita from Mikhail Bulgakov, most of the group found it wildly funny. While I was completely horrified by the story, I thought it might be worthwhile to pause here and take a close look. Maybe we could explore one or two scenes that Natalie believes are examples of dark humor, that could even form the basis for one of our book club questions. In this story, I had noticed something quite different. This isn't the typical narrative structure I've grown used to, where we are invaded, become victims, and eventually emerge as heroes resisting the villains. That kind of story is familiar to me from my upbringing with European post-war literature, where the heroic Allied forces stand up against the German monsters. Red Sorghum tells a very different story. The Chinese soldiers and the villagers at the heart of this book are often extremely violent, not just towards their enemies, but also amongst themselves. I found this unsettling and fascinating. Why would Mo Yan choose to depict his own people this way? Why make brutality sort of common? What is he trying to say through this portrayal? To explore this further, I propose to find two scenes from the book that depict extreme violence, each from a different perspective. There was more that came up during our first meeting about Red Sorghum. Natalie and I wondered how could Mo Yan imagine a story set so far back in time. He wrote the book in 1986, but the story begins in the 1920s and moves on from there. Natalie mentions she was particularly intrigued by the flash forwards that make it difficult to understand the story. I had noticed something else. Repetition. Often, Mo-Yan would first tell us something would happen in the future in about two or three lines. Then about 60 pages further in the story, you would be right in the middle of that same incident, and it would be described in vivid visceral detail, sometimes taking up three or four pages. Many of these descriptions made my stomach turn in disgust and disbelief. The names of the characters also stood out to me. 18 Stab Wound Gang, Sun 5, Little 9, Tan Family Hollow, Pocky Leng. Second grandma, father, grandfather, great-grandfather. I wondered, are these descriptive names a particular Chinese tradition, maybe? Another pattern we noticed is Mo Yan's repeated use of color. Although the color red is dominant, other colors keep coming up too. We come across an emerald fireball, a green liquid curtain, green flames, green waves, black winds, white pouches, red clouds, and clear blue tears. At some point in our conversation, Natalie mentioned that her mother had kept a diary while growing up in China. She said she'd love to read through it again someday, maybe even do something with it. That sparked a question in my mind. Would her mother's diary all be full of colors? Her color is something you would be more used to see and mention when you grow up in China, maybe? I asked Natalie if she might be willing to look through her mother's diary and see where the color showed up in it. We were both intrigued by the idea, and Natalie agreed to give it a try. All these elements, the fragmented timeline, the repetition, the descriptive names, the overall presence of colors, they stood out to us. We couldn't exactly pinpoint why and how it worked. We wondered about this and we wanted to delve in deeper. Natalie and I agreed to meet again in 2 weeks' time, just 1 week before book club, to share our findings. We were going to do some homework. Fast forward 2 weeks. We meet again at Saint Germain. This time it is so cold, we sit close to the little gas heater and we cover our legs with blankets to stay warm. We have a coffee and share our findings. Natalie researched her mother's diary, but couldn't find any use of colors in the text. Her mother wrote mainly about what happens in her life and how she felt about it. Then Natalie tells me that one particular passage from Red Sorghum sparked a memory. I'll read the passage. It's on page 94. It was Grandma's tiny feet that had caught the attention of Shang Tingshu, and it was her tiny feet that had aroused the passion of the sedan bearer Yu Zanao. She was very proud of them. Even a pock-faced witch is assured of marriage if she has tiny bound feet, but no one wants a girl with large unbound feet, even if she has the face of an immortal. Grandma, with her bound feet and lovely face, was one of the true beauties of her time. Throughout our long history, the delicate, pointed tips of women's feet have been viewed as genital organs, in a way, from which men have derived a sort of aesthetic pleasure that sets their sexual juices flowing. Then Natalie tells me, a Chinese custom that my mother told me about was the binding of the feet of young girls to change their shape and size. My mother said that this was done because men liked small feet and that this has also stopped the woman from running away. Signs of a patriarchal society. She did not tell us that the bones of the feet were broken and bound and that young girls, as young as 5, had bound feet and would stay at home to do handiwork, which was sold for an income for the family. My mother did not mention either that men found small feet erotic. She was shocked at this cruel practice. In the story, Little Nine's bound feet move out from beneath the fabric of the sedan chair, and that small glimpse is what sparks her future husband's love. But in Natalie's real-life memory, her mother never spoke of the sexual associations. We both wondered, was this something her mother chose not to share? Or was it simply something not done to say out loud at the time? After all, it was a different time, Many things were not discussed as openly as we are used to now. We move to the second element that Natalie picked up on in the story, dark humor. The first sign appears in a motto. I'll read it to you. With this book, I respectfully invoke the heroic, aggrieved souls wandering in the boundless, bright red sorghum fields of my hometown. As your unfilial son, I am prepared to carve out my heart, marinate it in soya sauce, have it minced and placed in 3 bowls, and lay it out as an offering in a field of sorghum. Partake of it in good health. Natalie laughs again at the soya sauce detail. And here's another example from page 52 that apparently also strikes a dark, humorous tone. With a flurry of shots, the bearers and musicians fell upon the highwayman, fists and feet flying. The initial onslaught was met by screams and shrill cries, which soon died out. Grandma stood beside the road listening to the dull cacophony of fists and feet on flesh. She glanced at Yusanao, then looked up at the lightning-streaked sky, the radiant, golden, noble smile still frozen on her face. One of the musicians raised his trumpet and brought it down hard on the highwayman's skull, burying the curved edge so deeply he had to strain to free it. The highwayman's stomach gurgled, and his body, racked by spasms, grew deathly still. He lay spread-eagled on the ground. A mixture of white and yellow liquid seeping slowly out of the fissure in his skull. "Is he dead?" asked the musician, who was examining the bent mouth of his trumpet. "He's gone, the poor bastard. He didn't put up much of a fight." At Book Club, the question we want to explore is, what do you think Mo-Yan wants to portray with this dark humor? While preparing for this discussion, I had come across Mo-Yan's Nobel acceptance speech from 2012, and it had moved me deeply. I believe it is exceptional. Reading the text of that speech gave me a much deeper understanding of red sorghum. I'll share a passage. A storyteller once came to the marketplace, and I sneaked off to listen to him. She, his mom, was unhappy with me for forgetting my chores. But that night, while she was stitching padded clothes for us under the weak light of a kerosene lamp, I couldn't keep from retelling stories I'd heard that day. She listened impatiently at first, since in her eyes, professional storytellers were smooth-talking men in a dubious profession. Nothing good ever came out of their mouths. But slowly she was dragged into my retold stories. And from that day on, she never gave me chores on market day. Unspoken permission to go to the marketplace and listen to new stories. As repayment for mother's kindness and a way to demonstrate my memory, I'd retell the stories for her in vivid detail. This passage revealed something important to me. I suddenly understood why color plays such a prominent role throughout red sorghum. It's a remnant of oral storytelling, a tradition Mo-Yan grew up with, as he shares in his speech. It also answers my question I had earlier. How could Mo-Yan describe events from so long ago, where he himself was not present? In this story, Mo-Yan repeatedly describes the color of the sorghum, of the dogs, of people, of the sky, the soil. This, I believe, is a functional part of how oral stories are told. It brings the scene from a covered past to life for the listener, but it also helps the storyteller maintain the thread. When you're telling a story orally, especially in front of an audience, like in a market square, you rely on techniques that help you remember and structure the story. Repetition is key here. Repeating details like colors help keep the rhythm and anchors the memory, both for the storyteller and the listener. In contrast, the diaries of Natalie's mom didn't include color. They focused more on events and emotions. That makes sense, as diaries are written records of what happened, not oral performances. So knowing that Mo-Yan's storytelling is rooted in oral tradition, the repeated use of color, along with elements like flashbacks, flash-forwards, and frequent naming of characters, suddenly feels entirely logical. The storyteller in the market square begins with the outline of a sketch, the memory of the past, and fills it in using a specific toolset, vivid detail, colors, descriptive names, and repeated fragments told in both a forward and backward manner. These techniques make the story accessible to the audience and possible for the teller to perform in the moment. We frame the next book club question as follows. Mo Yan's writing practice is said to be rooted in oral telling. Did you pick this up while reading the book or not? I also want to take a closer look at the cruelty portrayed in the book. Whose cruelty are we witnessing? Which side is cruel? I found two passages I'd like to share with the book club and with you. On page 343, I read, "Afterwards, way off in the distance, she heard little auntie let out a blood-curdling scream. Struggling to open her eyes, she could not believe what she saw. The young soldier with the lovely eye stood on the kang and lifted little auntie on the point of his bayonet, swung her in a couple of arcs, then flung her away. Like a huge bird flapping its wings, she sailed slowly through the air and landed on the floor next to the kang. Her little red jacket fell open in the sunlight and began to spread out like a piece of soft, smooth, red silk, gradually filling the room with undulating waves. During her flight, little auntie's arms froze in the air and her hair stood up like porcupine quills. The young Japanese soldier, rifle in hand, wept clear blue tears. Second grandma screamed for all she was worth and strained to sit up, but her body was dead by then. A wave of yellow flashed before her eyes, followed by a green light. Finally, she was swallowed up by an inky black tide." On page 143, I had earlier read, "What will do with their bodies, Commander Yu?" the old man asked. "If we'll bury them, they'll stink up our soil. If we burn them, they'll foul our air. Dump them into the river and let them float back home." 30 or more corpses were dragged up onto the bridge, including the old Jap, who had been stripped off his general's uniform by the Leng detachment soldiers. "You woman, look away," Granddad announced. He took out his short sword, split open the crotches of the Jap soldiers' pants, and sliced off their genitalia. Then he ordered a couple of the coarser men to stuff the things into the mouths of their owners. Finally, working in pairs, the men picked up the Japanese soldiers, basically decent men, perhaps, maybe handsome at one time, virtually all in the prime of their youth, and 1, 2, 3, heave them over the side. "Jap dogs," they shouted, "go back home." The Japanese soldiers flew through the air, carrying the family jewels in their mouths, and landed in the river with a splash, a whole school of them caught up in the eastward flow. Is there equality in cruelty on both sides? This is the question that began to take shape in my mind, and then I remembered a passage from Mo Yan's Nobel acceptance speech that seems to speak directly to this tension. "I know that nebulous terrain exists in the hearts and minds of every person, terrain that cannot be adequately characterized in simple terms of right and wrong, or good and bad. And this vast territory is where a writer gives free rein to his talent. Do you notice the similarities in the two scenes? The bayonet and the sword, the horror and the language? The question we decide to frame for the discussion is, who is cruel in this story? Why do you think Mo Yan shows acts of cruelty in horrific detail on both sides? And lastly, Mo Yan also plays with contradictions. I'd like to share two passages that appear quite close together. I need you to listen closely to what they are saying. Page 340. "Under normal circumstances, it is the power of morality that keeps the beast in us hidden beneath a pretty exterior. A stable, peaceful society is a training ground for humanity, just as caged animals, removed from the violent unpredictability of the wild are influenced by the behavior of their captors in time. Do you agree? Yes? No? Well, say it. Yes or no? If I weren't a man myself, and if I were holding the sword of vengeance in my hand, I'd slaughter every last man on earth. If there had been just one Japanese soldier facing Second Grandma's naked body that day, maybe he would have thought of his mother or his wife and left quietly. What do you think? And then, just a few pages later, on page 352, I read this. I sometimes think that there is a link between the decline in humanity and the increase in prosperity and comfort. Prosperity and comfort are what people seek, but the costs to character are often terrifying. Now, to me, that's a contradiction. In the first passage, the narrator suggests that stability and peace train us into being more humane, that they help suppress our inner beast. But a few pages later, he claims that prosperity and comfort, which are also the fruits of peace, lead to the decline of humanity. How do we make sense of that? Natalie agrees. It's puzzling. And so we frame our last question like this. How do you make sense of these two seemingly contradictory statements? What is Mo-Yan really saying about morality, suffering, and what shapes our character? By now, you're probably curious what our fellow book club readers thought of the book and of the questions we raised. So come with me. Let's jump to the evening of book club. It was a very cold night, but good food, good wine, and a stack of extra blankets worked to keep us warm and keep us talking. Not everyone had managed to finish the book. The repetition of graphic violence and horror proved difficult for some. Barbara finished it, but didn't like the story at all. Two participants couldn't get through it. It was just too much. One of us skipped the middle part. However, one fellow member read every sentence and even watched the movie. But whether or not the story was finished, the book left a profound, visceral imprint on each reader. One reader in our circle had done some research into how red sorghum is grown. She discovered the crop is irrigated by flooding. And when she told us that, I got goosebumps. Because to me, the land in this story is continually flooded with blood and violent deaths. Natalie explains to the group her link to China via her mother. She brought photos of a traditional sedan chair, of professional whalers and several of her mother, who lived in China and had experienced these customs firsthand. She tells about the diary and her discovery that it did not mention any colors. She explains to us the stories of her mother about the binding of the feet left a deep imprint on her. Her mother always told her it was a custom done to keep the woman from running away from home. There was never any mention of a sexual connection in these stories. We try to make sense of that and imagine when Natalie's mother was raising her. It was a different time and she might not have wanted or dared to talk about the sexual component of this custom. Then Natalie does something unexpected. She takes out an A4 paper and she starts to read to us. It's a kind of letter to the group, to us. I found it deeply moving. So I've asked Natalie if she would want to read this letter in the studio for the podcast. And she said yes. So here she is. Natalie, welcome and thank you for coming into the studio to read your letter in person.
Thank you very much. So let me now read a letter that I wrote about my mother. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to think about all the beautiful memories and for bringing back so many beautiful memories.
You're welcome.
My mother, Josette Marie Simone Gaudin. I first heard about a faraway place called China from my mother, who was born in the Far East in Vietnam, which was then French Indochina. She spoke of her Chinese nurse who sang Chinese lullabies to her, and in fact she used to tell us that her first language was Chinese. She spoke very warmly of the domestique chinois and the cuisinier chinois and of the food and of the traditions, in particular the cruel binding of young girls' feet. I can still hear her voice as she read to us, and a book that my sisters and I so enjoyed and which made us cry was The Cat Who Went to Heaven. The first words of the book were these, Once upon a time, far away in China, a poor young artist sat alone in his house waiting for his dinner. It was this book, which my mother read to us over and over again, that gave me the sense of how far away and how rich in spirituality China was, and it made my mother's early life feel so incredibly far away. Growing up in Johannesburg meant that the closest my mother could get to experiencing Chinese culture was through Chinese food, and we so enjoyed going to Sai Wu in Parkwood for special occasions. I loved feeling different when I told my friends that my mother lived in China and felt proud when they came to play at my grandparents' house, and I showed them all the beautiful photographs, ornaments, and furniture from Peking. I have inherited a magnificent red gold embossed Chinese chest from my grandparents, and this chest now represents to me all that I never asked my mother and my grandparents about China, about the people, the history, the traditions, the wisdom, and all that I still have to learn and understand about this vast land and ancient civilization. Most of what my mother told us was a restricted view coming from her colonial upbringing, but she did not know this, just as we were not aware either of her Western-centric perception. How fortunate we are to read novels like Red Sorghum, which celebrates, in horrific circumstances of war and poverty, the vitality and determination of Chinese women for self-fulfillment. And how privileged we are to get to know an author as gifted and as modest as Mo Yan, who has enriched my knowledge of China and its people more than I could have ever learned through my mother and my grandparents.
Natalie, I believe all of us present were deeply moved by your letter. Thank you for writing it, and thank you for reading it here.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
After Natalie's touching letter, we turn to the question of dark humor. Interestingly, everyone had noticed it, except me. A depiction of the murder of two mules in the beginning of the story is mentioned as a classic example. Everyone laughed when I admitted I hadn't picked up on that at all. We try to discover what it is in me that I don't pick it up. Barbara mentioned her own book, Will, the Passenger Delaying Flight, which I've read, and she says to me, "That's totally funny." And I respond with surprise and laughter and tell Barbara, "But I didn't find anything funny in that book at all." We laughed again. Apparently, I totally had missed the point. We eventually conclude it most probably has to do with English being my second language, or that maybe humor works a little different in the Netherlands. But when it came to why Mo Yan uses dark humor, the group agreed without hesitation. It's a coping mechanism. Describing horror in such detail forces the mind to go over what happened and become aware of it and not hide it in the self. Mo Yan pulls the horror in the open. He exposes what happened and puts it in the awareness and consciousness of the society. As for Mo Yan's storytelling being rooted in oral tradition, that insight hadn't occurred to anyone in the group. And to be fair, it hadn't occurred to me either until I read his Nobel acceptance speech. But after one of us had read that part of the speech aloud, the part where Mo Yan talks about him listening at the market square to storytellers, suddenly everything falls into place. The repetition, the use of color, the flashbacks and flash-forwards, the descriptive names. All the elements that had made the book feel so difficult at first now made sense. They weren't just quirks, they were tools of oral storytelling. We move on to read the two passages of extreme violence followed by the quote from the acceptance speech. Something shifts in Barbara. I sat next to her and the shift was almost literal. She makes a 180-degree turn in her opinion. The discussion and realization that Mo Yan, on purpose, depicted his own people and also their enemy, the Japanese, as equally violent, equally humane, made her admire the writer and his story more. While we talk about the idea of us humans being equally capable of violence, Ada, another loyal member, wants to read two passages she found interesting because they contradict each other. I laugh and say, "Wait for it, that is question four." It turns out she noticed the exact same contradiction as I had. We both giggle. A shared discovery is a delight to experience. We agree the contradiction says something essential about us as human beings. I believe we don't thrive in extreme poverty. But we are also not always at our best when surrounded by too much comfort. Luxury problems are problems too. It is something I have come to realize over the years, and this quote gives that realization some kind of confirmation. The group agrees. The two extremes, poverty and luxury, exist and can become equally problematic, unfortunately. The evening comes to a close. I invite everyone, and I'm inviting you too, loyal listener, to read Mo Yan's acceptance speech. You can find it on the website of the Nobel Prize organization. It is titled Storytellers. Reading that speech made me want to explore much more of Mo Yan's work. His other books are now on my to-read list. The speech also inspired me to try something new. I believe reading and writing is intertwined, and I got an idea. What if I looked into a told memory from my own family and tried to write a story with the elements that Mo Yan showed me, the repetition, the use of color, the flashbacks and flash-forwards, the descriptive names? What kind of story might come from that? I sat myself down and wrote one, and I'd like to end this episode with that story. I hope you'll enjoy. They call her Red Round Face. She is a swimmer. Every morning before school, she is in the water, but nobody knows, not even her parents. She cycles past the church, the windmill, and over the bridge to the public pool. Every dive into the clear blue and crisp water soothes her soul. The gentle touch of the liquid calms her body, creating a silver shield all over her skeleton to protect her from the knife-stabbing words that will without a doubt enter her body later in the day at the schoolyard. That afternoon, after school, she doesn't go home, but she rings the doorbell of her neighbor, the butcher. His wife answers. A tall, skinny, and bony woman looks at her. She, who is called Red Round Face, holds up a form and asks, "Will you support my swimming marathon?" 2 guilders per 50 meter. The bony, skinny and tall woman looks down on Red Round Face and signs the paper, "Of course you dear." Red Round Face lowers her head and mumbles shy in a whisper, "Thank you." She goes to every door in her village. It takes her the whole week. Each and every one looks down on Red Round Face, and each one signs the form. On Monday she begins. She swims, and she only stops when it gets too dark. She cycles home alone. Then Tuesday, again. And Wednesday, again. On Thursday, she does the same routine. She swims, and she only stops when it gets too dark. Friday is her last day. She swims even in the dark. All other kids have left the water, but Red Round Face still swims. The others dance on the grass at the music festival. Red Round Face not. She is still in the water. Finally, Red Round Face gets out of the water. She dresses and she cycles home, over the bridge, via the windmill, via the church. When she's home, she goes to sleep. Saturday morning, she gets up early, eats a breakfast, a brown sandwich and 2 fried eggs, sunny side up. She gets up from the table, walks to the hallway, grabs her school bag. She takes out all her forms and she walks out of the front door to the butcher's house. She rings the doorbell. Her neighbor, the bony, tall, slim woman, opens the door and looks down at Red Round Face. Red Round Face hands her the form and holds up her other hand. The eyes of the tall, bony and skinny woman fall almost out of their sockets. Her jaw drops 15 centimeters. Her mouth moans. Each person that opens their door that morning lets out a different sound. They differ in tonality, but they all come from that same place down below in the tummy. Red Round Face hears high-pitched shrieks, caved bellows, moist ahs, and some more. Red Round Face says nothing. Not a whisper leaves her mouth. She just holds up the form in the one hand. The other is open, palm up, waiting to receive the money that is now rightfully hers. Clever girl! How was this for you, Natalie? To hear back, yeah, me telling you how we prepared and what happened at book club, how was that?
I could follow exactly your wonderful train of thought through the everything. The book club worked very smoothly through the questions and opened up a lot of interesting debate, yeah. Most definitely. And I find it interesting, yes, some book club members struggled with the book,
yeah.
Couldn't read the book because of the brutal violence. And as you say, the passages that you read, that is the responsibility of the writer to portray things as they were. I think that writers must be bold and courageous and truthful.
Yeah, for me, it's also always fascinating how when books are kind of similar, like The Master and the Margarita and Red Sorghum, this time I could, not easily, but I was in the story and I wanted to finish it, while The Master and the Margarita had the opposite effect of me. So it's sometimes so strange how a book can affect you differently.
Yes, and I loved what you said about the color. I know that that was something that really, well, the title, Red Sorghum.
Yeah.
And how we worked through questions dealing with color and how the color also is revealed in the writing and in the wonderful text that you wrote, that you read to us. And that color is, yes, it's about the oral tradition, about memories, evokes all sorts of symbolic. For me now, the red chest of my grandparents, the red is very much now symbolic of China.
It was very moving to me when you said that chest represents all that you didn't ask or couldn't ask.
Yes.
Yeah. So yes. Thank you for sharing that.
I realize as one grows older and you read, you realize that true knowledge lies in books. Of course, it lies in speaking to people. Perhaps that is more important. But with my parents, and you're quite right, with my mother, it was a very sort of formal upbringing, and my mother never spoke about sex. So I think that the feet were very much, the binding of the feet were very much the fact that which gave us really not a very good idea of marriage, but that the woman couldn't run away, which is quite extraordinary. Going back to Moyan and storytelling, I think that storytelling also gives one one can look back and criticize traditions. You can pick up what is good and you can pick up what is bad, or what is moral and what is immoral. And Moyan is opening all these traditions to us for us to make our own moral judgment on them.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing and thank you for coming.
Well, thank you very much, Christy.
Thank you, listener, for staying tuned. I hope this episode gave you some insights about China, storytelling, and maybe even inspired you to pick up one of Moyan's books. Hope to have you back for the next one.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.